This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 KOGO. I'm Scott Lewis, the CEO and editor-in-chief at Voice of San Diego. I'm joined, as always, by assistant editor Andrew Keats. Hello, Andy.
Scott, how are we?
I'm very well, thank you. Feeling really, it's a nice day. Good. I've seen breezes of normality, whiffs of more of normality. It's really helping my mental health. And Sarah Libby, managing editor, hello.
Hello.
Have you felt any breezes of normality?
No, quite the opposite.
We'll talk about that in a minute. Coming up on the show today, San Diego Unified has announced that it will announce the next phase of reopening schools. We'll talk about how phase one has gone and some of the inequities we're worried about there, always inequities. And continuing with the youth theme, we've got a new story about sports and how youth sports is adapting and, of course, creating inequities. There are a lot of things that caught our attention with school access and the youths this week, so we will talk of the youths. Plus, as we gear up for the election, which is just not even 2 weeks, we're talking about like 10 days or something, right? 11 days away. We'll talk about Measure E. It's about the height limit in the Midway Pacific Highway area. And the pivotal race for County Board of Supervisors District 3, our Jesse Marks has done a couple of stories about what the Democrats would do if they win control of the Board of Supervisors or what the Republicans will do. But first, it is a tradition that you now know and love. Voice of San Diego's podcast Election Draft returns next week. That'll be our last podcast before Election Day. So make sure you've picked your races so we can compare. Be sure you're subscribed or following this podcast wherever you listen so you do not miss it. You're going to start figuring out your draft picks, Andy?
Yeah, I'm putting together my draft board, huddling with Mel Kiper, and getting all of our
Are we going to do a White Claw-laced election night podcast?
I don't see why not.
Yeah, absolutely.
With one important contingency that...
If
the nightmare scenario were to take place at the national level, you can go ahead and count on not hearing from us.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens with everything. There's a lot of state propositions. I'll be looking right away at Prop 15, Prop 22, Measure E, of course, the mayor's race, a lot of different ones to choose from. We're including measures in our draft, right, guys?
Oh, that's interesting. Absolutely. Yeah, definitely.
There's some good measures to be considering there. All right, let's talk about the youth. A couple weeks ago, San Diego Unified School District, second largest school district in the state of California, and of course the largest in San Diego County. It has been closed since Tom Hanks Day back in March. At least in-person campuses have been closed. Last 2 weeks ago or so, they opened for phase one of in-person instruction. This is basically appointment-based special needs. So if your child has special needs and was falling really far behind, and if the school identified them as somebody who is falling behind, it's not something you could apply for, then you might have gotten an invitation to get some appointment-based services on campus in addition to the online education that was happening. That has been in place for now almost 2 weeks. Our Will Huntsbury did a story about how it was entirely up to the educators whether they wanted to participate in this or not. And a lot of them, turns out, didn't. He talked to Donis Coronel. She's the executive director of the local principals union. And she told Will that she talked to 25 to 30 elementary school principals, and at least half of them said they had maybe one teacher or zero coming back. I know at some schools, the only things that were happening in person were actual special needs assessments, not actual instruction or anything like that. And of course, yet another area where there's some inequities brewing. Did I summarize that enough, Sarah?
I think so. And like you identified this big irony of it, which is that they structured it in a way to try and bring people back and address, you know, educational inequities that were happening because of distance learning. And they ended up opening up this new inequity in that it's available to some students who happen to attend schools where teachers have decided to come back and not to others, you know, at schools where there's no one there.
Yeah. And it just sort of furthers a lot of this experience we're watching. We see private schools that are having in-person services. Poway Unified has been open. San Dieguito. Is San Dieguito the best name, by the way? So good. San Dieguito, just little San Diego. They open. There's a lot of wealthier areas that have school access and a lot of places that don't. And so, yeah, we're trying to round that up. They did want to use the phase one, not just to address the inequities, but also to be able to test and prove that they could have people on campuses and that they would have data back. And so it's that data that they want to be analyzing now to see if it's possible to move to phase two. And today, Thursday, we got an indication of what phase two may look like. And the district announced that it would announce next week on Tuesday, I guess that's Tuesday, the 27th of October, when they may move to phase two. Now, phase two would be really significant. I was actually kind of surprised at how big it would be. Pre-K to fifth graders would be able to go back 4 days a week, half days, 5 days. The fifth day, they would stay at home. And this is the big one in my eyes. Secondary 6th through 12th grade students would be able to go back to high school and middle schools 2 days a week. My cousin Lex would be stoked about that. We are not sure, though, when, of course, again, they announced that they would announce, and there was one crucial part of the announcement. They said, we're going to wait for the numbers to come out on Tuesday from the county public health officials about where we're at with the virus. And, of course, we've been teetering on that purple level for a while, and I'm sure if we go into purple, they'll probably say something about how we're not going to phase two.
Well, it seems like if the purple tier is indicative of what we can do, it would have to be the case, right?
Yeah, I don't. There's only one reason to wait till Tuesday, and it's for that determination. And if they want to wait to get that determination, that's what they're waiting for. But you know, of course, there's a lot of things that still have to happen. They may identify a date, but they haven't made a deal with the teachers union, and the teachers union has a lot of the leverage here. I wouldn't call what they're doing a work stoppage as much as they are the ones who are going to have the influence to decide whether they feel comfortable going back to school or not. And if they do not want to, they have the power not to. And it's very simple.
Wouldn't it be fair to assume, though, that those conversations have probably happened? I can't imagine that the district leadership would get out in front with an announcement that they're going to have to then sell to the school, to the teachers union.
You can't really imagine that. Actually, I think it's exactly what happened with phase one. Remember, they said that people were going to come back September, at the end of September. And then they said, we never actually said, we got it wrong. We're not going to go back. We have to decide when it's safe to go back. Well, it turns out they had gotten ahead of their skis. They announced that before they had the deal with the teachers union. And so they ended up having to, I guess it got delayed about a week or two before they could do it because of that very thing. So I think they might have learned, not, and I'm sure they probably had conversations, but I don't know. They don't let me in on those, that's for sure.
No.
I'm interested in how parents react to this, you know, model that's been laid out. Obviously, everybody... Scott, I think you've maybe talked about this once or twice over the last 6 months, are interested in schools opening and in-person learning happening. I feel like I heard you mention that once, maybe.
It's been on the side. Yeah, it's been something I thought
so
about.
So presumably,
yeah.
Like,
the joke is 'cause you won't shut up about it.
Yeah, thank you for explaining
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I got it.
Presumably, like, some school and some in-person instruction is better than none, and it's probably a relief to parents and kids to be able to go back a little bit, or to go back a couple days. But in this model where you're in school some of the time and out of school some of the time, you would still, I assume, need childcare on those other days, which means, you know, if you're participating yeah. in a pod or something like that, you're broadening your you're exposed to your classmates in the school and you're exposed to your pod mates outside of school, and you're kind of mixing those two together. So if the whole point is to minimize exposure by only having kids go to school 1 or 2 days, it seems like you could, there's an argument you're actually doing the opposite of that.
Yeah, I think that was my wife's first reaction to this. Like, we're both really excited to see maybe some movement and progress, but her first reaction was like, what do I do with the rest of the day? You know, I mean, and what will probably, I think, be an interesting accompaniment to this is what you do on normal half days in San Diego Unified. Most of us let our kids go to the YMCA aftercare program on those days. So remember, every normal school week in San Diego Unified, there's one day that's a half day at elementary schools. And that's when the YMCA goes and picks them up and spends the next 4 hours with them. You didn't know that, did you, Andy?
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's something you find out the first week. You're like, oh, they don't go to school all day, every day, it turns out. And so
I was not counting on that. My kid's going to be going to school sometime soon. That wasn't part of the plan.
No,
okay, good to know.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I think, do they allow the why to do those programs that supplement that for a while? There's another big question. I will say I read the thing that made me feel the best about San Diego Unified's efforts through this that I've read in the last 6 months, and it was in La Jolla Light. This guy, the COO of the San Diego Unified, is a guy named Drew Rollins. He's the chief operating officer. I have never encountered Mr. Rollins before, but apparently he spoke at the La Jolla Cluster parents meeting. And he was great based on this La Jolla Light reporting of what he did. He talked about how it's all about cleaning the air. It's all about ventilation. They're going to use carbon dioxide monitoring to check whether the air is turning over 5 times per hour in a room and thus is getting enough air exchange and ventilation. It's a first guy who seemed to really understand and articulate what they were going to do based on what they're learning from these scientists at UC San Diego, and then proof that they're actually going to achieve, you know, this ventilation as they hope to, and how they can just demonstrate that in a way that teachers could literally check, and they could check these rooms. I just found it a really, you know, you don't see a lot of that, and they got to get him out, talk to every teacher possible, every parent possible, and they might be able to get somewhere. All right, well, there is a phase 3 and phase 4. I'm not even letting myself read the descriptions of those. Those are, you know, 4 days a week, 4 days a week for high school kids. That would be really interesting to watch, but let's see if phase 2 happens at all before we get into that. There is another thing brewing. The UT's done some reporting, and then, of course, our Ashley McGlone did a story this week about youth sports. Cities like Yuma, Phoenix, Tucson are allowing competitions for youth sports. Here, they are not allowed, so you can have practice. You can have you know, you can, like, my daughter played in a softball team. They practiced a lot, and they had scrimmages that sure did look like games, but you're not allowed to have official games. But they are allowed in Arizona, and so a lot of these really competitive youth sports leagues are carpooling, getting hotel rooms, and going to Arizona with all the risks that entail. And a lot of them are like, look, we're not denying the virus trouble. We just you know, our kids want to play and we want to help them play. So let's go to Arizona. It was a kind of fascinating story, Sarah, about the logistics of just what they're going through to make that work.
Yeah, there's a few pretty wild pieces of it. Like, one is that you're driving hundreds of miles or 100 miles. I have no real sense of how far away Arizona is, apparently, now that I'm saying it out loud, to play sports teams that are probably like a few miles away from you. Like, Solana Beach is driving to Arizona to play a Del Mar team or whatever. So that's pretty weird. And then, you know, you mentioned carpooling, but I think actually they're not allowed to carpool and they're not allowed to share hotels. Right. And so it's quite a burden on parents and families to have to do this all themselves. And there's not like a lot of sharing the costs or the time that it takes to get your kids all the way to Arizona and back for the weekend. And so a lot of coaches and parents expressed worry that like the longer and longer this drives on, it's not going to be sustainable for all that many families to constantly be driving to Arizona, to constantly be buying hotel rooms in Arizona, which apparently are quite spendy since the demand is there. So it's wild.
Yeah. So you have even another area of inequity getting exacerbated where, you know, people who can afford that, have the resources to do that, are going to literally get ahead, maybe get more training, more elite practice. And you know, where there's a will, there's always going to be a way with some of these parents.
Yeah.
Andy, you were an elite youth athlete, right?
Yes. That's correct.
Would your parents have driven you to Arizona from here?
Arizona's far.
Yeah.
That's far. That's like the equivalent of like being driven to like Pittsburgh from Baltimore.
Yeah. And it's
maybe not Yuma. Phoenix is the equivalent of Pittsburgh, but Yuma, I guess, is much closer.
Yeah. Well, remember when the fires were here in 2003, Mike Aguirre, who was running for city attorney, he came up with a plan that we were all going to evacuate to Yuma. And he was really mad that we didn't, like the entire city of San Diego, evacuating to Yuma. In fact, he evacuated to Yuma on election night because he was so nervous about what was happening and he couldn't stand to watch it anymore. He went to Yuma.
Okay.
Maybe this guy just likes Yuma.
Yeah, I think he did.
Like, I'm trying to tell you, it's cool.
It's a really nice place.
I do that just to illustrate that Yuma has always been an outlet for some people, apparently, for a while. When in doubt, go to the Colorado River, I guess. All right. Well, check out Ashley's story at voiceofsandiego.org. There is a lot going on. Sarah, you got the best not school announcement, I think, this week. What was it, like the Hilton or the Hyatt that was like, come stay with us. We'll take care of your kids and you can go get like massages and we'll make sure they get a good education. Wink, wink, no problem.
Yeah. I mean, we've been hearing for a long time hotels kind of marketing themselves as like staycation destination. So that's not new, but I got this press release. I think it was the Hyatt, saying, you know, relax by the pool, get massages, but also we've arranged super educational field trips to the zoo and the harbor and whatnot. So we will take care of your kids because we know you have nowhere to send them.
Yeah, it was the Marriott Marquis downtown. So, it was Parents' Day Off, fall travel package now available. While the kids are away on field trips and learning, you can hang out and get a spa treatment and relax. It sounded like heaven.
Yeah, like it's not like a no for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't, by no means do I begrudge them the marketing chops there, but boy, not the sign of a healthy society. Things aren't going well when that's hitting your mailbox.
Okay, so one of the races we've talked about a lot is the race for District 3 of the County Board of Supervisors. There's 5 SUPs who represent different parts of San Diego County, not the city, the whole county. And it could go either way. District 1's definitely going to get a Republican. I mean, a Democrat. There's two Democrats running in that seat. District 2 is definitely going to get a Republican. There's two Republicans running for that seat. But District 3 has an incumbent Republican and a very serious, well-funded challenger from the left, Democrat, Tara Loss-Reamer. So incumbent Kristen Gaspar is fighting for her seat there. And depending on how this race turns out, I cannot overemphasize how different the county governance could be based on which direction this goes. So let's say Kristen Gaspar wins, retains her seat. Somebody like Steve Voss or Joel Anderson wins in District 2, the Republican. And then there's, you know, essentially at that point, there's three Republicans in charge. But by the way, three much more movement conservative, pretty, I think, significantly more conservative than the existing Republicans that are on the board who are termed out. And so I think you have a much more actually conservative board of supervisors than we've seen maybe ever on the board of supervisors. But if it goes the other way, you have Democrat Nathan Fletcher, who's already there, either Ben Waso or Nora Vargas from District 1, the South Bay. And then you have a very progressive liberal, Tara Loss-Reamer, who you end up having by far the most progressive left of center board of supervisors we've seen. So it's incredible how much could change based on that.
Yeah, to compare it to the city council, like the outcome of the city council races here, even the ones that are Republican versus Democrat, aren't going to change the entire like shape and constitution of the way the city council behaves. They represent marginal changes either way, right? The Democrats are going to have a majority either way. They're going to have a large majority either way, and so it's really tweaking at the edges where. Like you have directionally completely different situations at stake here in these county supervisor elections.
And it's not just like the political direction, which, as you mentioned, is like wild, the swings that it could take, but just like having a board filled with such big, intense personalities would be a lot different than it has been. You know, we're like most people don't know what the board does and couldn't name their supervisor or any of that. And to just have it be like a much more outspoken and aggressive entity filled with like wild personalities would be a big change on its own.
Yeah, like to take one very small example, like the Democrats have already sort of said, I think, that the convention, the longstanding convention that the chairmanship of the Board of Supervisors rotates on a year-to-year basis. That it's not a position that you run for. It just kind of moves around like a, like an ante in a poker game, and I think that's gone no matter what happens in these elections. Yeah. I think even if the Republicans are going to win, I don't anticipate Kristen Gaspar, Joel Anderson, and Jim Desmond. Being like, well, it's Nathan Fletcher's turn to be the chairman of the board.
Yeah,
we'll just take his lead, you know, or and after that, it's Nora Vargas's turn. You know, like I think that sort of old practice, and that's just one example of the Board of Supervisors is in the past, regardless.
And so Jesse Marks on our team, he did two stories, one about what the Democrats would do if they took over, and then one about what the new Republicans would do if they sort of keep it in Republican hands. And if I, Sarah, were to break down in the most simple form what he found, it's that it would be about spending. The Democrats want to spend billions of dollars to address behavioral health, homelessness. And there is probably a willingness to spend from the Republicans on these issues as well, but they're going to be far more reserved and they're going to have much different priority for how that spending goes, probably focus more on treatment as opposed to actual housing, things like that.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Kind of ironically, the one thing that they said they don't want to pull back on is police spending, so they aren't you know, amenable to any calls to change police budgets, like the sheriff's office. So they're fiscally conservative, except when it comes to that, I guess.
Or the DA's office, which, but that is one of the major things that the County Board of Supervisors does, mm-hmm. is they set the budget for the sheriff and the district attorney's office. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they're going to have some major decisions to make about outsourcing things like healthcare for the jail system. Obviously, a more conservative board is going to be way more into that. I'd be interested in your take is how it could be different versus if you have Steve Voss as the Republican from District 2, the East County seat, versus former state senator Joel Anderson. So Voss is the Poway mayor. He's kind of more of an establishment figure. Kevin Faulkner supports him. The incumbent county supervisor, Diane Jacobs, supports him heavily. Joel Anderson, much more of an ideological firebrand, but also has been known to work with people like Nathan Fletcher in the past, has this whole like bipartisan, thing that he tries, this brand that he tries to peddle. So it could be really interesting just to see which of those two comes out.
I just think it's like a variability. It's like the predictability of the seat changes. I think Steve Voss he's a conservative. There's no question that he's a conservative guy. But he's like an institutional conservative, whereas Joel Anderson is, I think, just unpredictable. He's also very conservative, probably to the right of Steve Voss. But I don't know that that's the biggest distinction as much as just there's no telling where he's going to be on anything or what he might decide to do.
Anderson, wasn't he the first local official, maybe the first in California to endorse Trump?
Yes, he was very, very early on.
Well, maybe I was thinking of Congress was Duncan Hunter.
Well, Duncan Hunter, but I think even Hunter came after Anderson.
No, he was proudly like, I'm on this train. Let's do it.
Yeah.
But he's also like, he's partnered with like Loretta on a couple different
things. Yeah, on multiple initiatives.
Assemblywoman. Yeah.
Yeah, on diaper initiatives. And he's partnered with Democrats on some privacy and surveillance issues during his time in the legislature. So, he's absolutely a wild card.
And then Voss, when you ask Voss about this, they're both trying to appeal to liberals right now. And Voss is like, well, hey, look, I'm endorsed by Diane Jacob. And Nathan Fletcher has only got what he's gotten done in the county because of the support by Diane Jacob. So, hey, wink, wink, I'm with him. It's a really interesting dynamic.
I would also point to Steve Voss's role at Sandag, where like there's been this very heated, very ideological left versus right fight on the Sandag board. And like Voss would never be mistaken as like a Alejandro Sotolo Solis or Catherine Blakespear or Georgette Gomez, like the actual progressive members of that board who have been pushing it to the left. But he has sort of tried to hold the water line on just how far outside of normality they can people can push things with protest votes and walking away from votes as a like to try to deprive the board of a quorum. Some of the things that went down on this fight over the audit recently, he's like really played like a protectionist role about the like the institution itself. And I think that speaks to who he would be on this board, which is a conservative guy, but a conservative guy who's not going to let things go out of control.
Yeah. I can also just see a board that includes Voss, Desmond, and Gaspar being fixated, almost like laser focus on Sandag and some of these transit issues. You know, they all three of them come from local government and have spent time on Sandag, whereas, you know, Joel Anderson's recent experiences at the state level, and I just don't know that that's his biggest priority or something that he's inclined to focus on. And so even just that alone would probably be a big difference priority-wise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Board of Supervisors, of course, the county oversees a lot of things related to food assistance, air pollution, healthcare, and, you know, if this does come out either way, it could have a major influence on the future of transit. There's big ideas on the left about transit, but they could easily be thwarted by how this goes at the county. District 3 County Supervisor Race, if you're in the district, you've got a big choice to make there. Another big choice, if you're within the city of San Diego, is Measure E. Measure E is the ballot measure, of course, that would take the Midway neighborhood. We talked about it last week. Midway, Pacific Highway. A lot of people actually, I've realized, don't know what we're talking about with Midway. It's talking about everywhere from the sports arena down through Midway and Sports Arena Drive, all the way to the Pacific Highway area where it ends at Old Town. Does not include the Marine Corps base, does not include the airport, but the areas right there around the industrial areas and the big sort of shopping center areas, those are what we're talking about here. And it would, Measure E would say, in those areas, you can build more than 30 feet high. Now, for 40 years, that area, along with most areas west of I-5, have been under a very strict 30-foot height limit imposed by voters, so it can only be changed by voters. And that's what Measure E is. There's a proposal, of course, for Sports Arena, but this affects the whole area. This week, our environment reporter, Mackenzie Elmer, did a really interesting story about one thing to think about here, and that is that in the world of climate change, it makes sense for more people to live by the coast. There's, you know, the temperatures are more steady, less need for either heat or cooling systems, and it's just a healthier as far as not needing transportation. Now that's pretty provocative for some of my neighbors on the coast, but I thought she did a good job explaining it.
Yeah, and she talked to some experts who said that in addition to the benefits of a temperate climate, as it pertains to energy use, because with higher energy use, more wild swings in temperature, you need to use more heat or more air conditioning. There's also just health effects of living in very hot climates, and that they manifest in all the way down to, like, you know, the weight of a baby born in the far eastern area, and the health of that baby compared to being closer to the coast. That it's just, generally speaking, healthier to live in temperate climates.
There's also, though, of course, if you are worried about sea level rise, you can't get too close to the sea. So it makes sense. But I thought the examination of that discussion, and that's a kind of a key part of this whole climate action plan that the city has gone on. And I don't think people quite understand. The city has committed to not just an ideal, a literal law that more people have to live within these already built environments than in exchange for allowing some of the outer areas to stay undeveloped, so that the transportation expenses, the consequences of transportation are contained, but then people are just organized better. And that is a key part of the climate action plan. And so a lot of folks, especially political leaders that are committed to that, I'm not sure that they've really committed, though, to what that implies. And this is kind of I thought it was just a good reminder of what that implies. And in many cases, it implies that they need to live, more people need to live in these areas.
Yeah. And, you know, one rebuttal is that, well, if we turn this down, or excuse me, if we agree to make it possible to build much more housing near the coast, that wouldn't mean that developers were unable to build in the sprawling areas. So you're acting as though this is an either or situation, but it may just be both. My response to that would be two things. One, even if it did end up being both, as the article demonstrates, it's just, generally speaking, healthier and better to allow more people to live near the coast. It's better for those people's health, and it's better for our overall energy use. And two, the city and county actually are, whether they abide by it or not is something different, but they are ostensibly bound to limit growth in the sprawling backcountry areas. And so there's an implied trade-off that restricting growth in those areas means allowing it in the already developed urban areas, and that happens in San Diego to be closer to the coast. But so you know, there really actually is supposed to be a trade-off. It is supposed to be an either-or situation.
Hmm. I got an interesting question when I was I did an Ask Me Anything on local Reddit, San Diego's subreddit, about the election, and somebody asked what happens if Measure E fails. And I thought that was a good actual exercise. If Measure E fails, the group that is sort of charged by the city with coming up with a plan for the sports arena areas, Brookfield development.
Yeah, they won a bid, but they have not, there is no contract.
Right.
And the city council could later after this election, or the next mayor could just redo that whole process.
Their position in this would probably be even more in doubt if this doesn't pass. And if it doesn't pass, also, though, they or whoever wants to redevelop the sports arena land would probably want to come forward again in 2022 for some sort of ballot initiative, and maybe just for the sports arena land. Remember, this covers the whole area of the Midway Community Planning District, and you could very easily just come back and say, okay, fine, we won't do that, but what if we just do the sports arena land? Because we literally can't build another sports arena, even at the same height as the current one, without a different height limit. Sarah?
So I think that's a good question, and I understand why people are asking it, but isn't it also true that the Midway Community Plan envisions like thousands and thousands of units of new housing, and that also seemingly would rely on the height limit being lifted? And so it's not, you know, everybody's asking, well, what's going to happen with the sports arena, which, fine, again, good question, but like, there are other implications as well, right? I don't know how you build thousands and thousands of new units that are all three stories high.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it would, it would almost certainly depress the number of new units you could produce there. And keep in mind, the company that won the bid to redevelop the sports arena didn't actually promise to rebuild the sports arena. So
there's also that.
So sports arena in this context, I take to be more a description of a location than a building.
Yeah, I guess isn't theoretically you could build that many homes, but it's just hard to imagine how they could be organized or profitable with such little land, right?
Yeah, I think yes, I think that's correct, and I think that came up when they passed the community plan, that it was ostensibly possible to reach those densities under three stories, but you know, you'd end up having to basically have like micro units, or you'd have to waive parking restrictions, or you'd have to basically build in all of the buildable areas with much less green space. While it is technically possible, I think it's safe to say that there would be many fewer new homes built in that area than allowed under that community plan if the height limit isn't increased.
Got it. Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast, recorded in 110 West A Street, right across the street from 101 Ash Street. Andy and I have a weekly newsletter we think you'll like. It's called The Politics Report. It comes out every Saturday. It's full of great news and tidbits from the week. Sarah's newsletter is What We Learned This Week, a recap of the week, and her fire take on it. Usually Voice of San Diego is managed very well. At least its content is by her, and she has some great insights. Get those at vosd.org/newsletters. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor-in-Chief. Sarah Libby's Managing Editor. Andrew Keats is Assistant Editor. And this show was produced expertly by Nate John. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.